Bonjour à tous, bienvenue pour cette rencontre avec Dave McKean. Je suis vraiment ravi d'être là et de partager ce moment avec lui et avec vous. Dave McKean a préparé des images qu'il va vous montrer et qu'il va commenter et que je vais peut-être, sur lesquelles je vais peut-être rebondir ou pas. Voilà, donc je vais lui laisser la parole et puis je réagirai quand j'estimerai que c'est peut-être adéquat. Donc si vous pouvez alors commencer par la première image.
Ok, hello, nice to see you. This is very strange wearing headphones. I won't. I was quite enjoying Herbie Hancock. Do you like Herbie Hancock? I think it's great. So I brought along lots of pictures because I very hard to work out what I do really, but it's mostly storytelling. And it's mostly visual storytelling. So I just brought a lot of pictures to show you. So I thought I'd bash through that. I started doing comics. Comics were my first love, and I met Neil Gaiman, who's around here somewhere, when I was still in art school. And we liked each other very much, and we liked I liked what he was writing. He seemed to like my drawings. And we both were quite ambitious. And so our first book was called Violent Cases, which we showed to editors at DC Comics and got... Surprisingly, they gave us work. I don't quite know why they gave us work, but they did.
I've got a question about...
Yes, go ahead. You should ask questions.
Vous avez dédié le livre, you dedicated the book to Alan Moore. And
I dedicated the book to my teacher, my art school teacher.
No, I read on the book that it's dedicated to Alan Moore and...
Neil may have dedicated it to Alan, but yeah. I dedicated it to my teacher.
So
I was that young.
And Bill Sienkiewicz too. Maybe it's Neil too.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that.
Oh, okay. So, but my question was about influences.
Well, yes, Neil's influence was very much Alan Moore, because he had interviewed Alan, and at the end of the interview, sat down with him and said, "Look, I really want to write comics as well. How do you do it?" So Alan took him through the process and was a big influence creatively, but also personally.
And yourself?
Bill Sienkiewicz was working in America at the time, and he was one of a small group of illustrators who were also doing comics. They were doing illustration, book covers, record covers, but they were also doing comic books. And there was also Kent Williams, John Muth, and George Pratt. There were only a few, and they were all very important. For me, still in art school. So I did this Batman book with a wonderful writer called Grant Morrison, who is a little bit mad, but in a good way, I think. And I could not relate to Batman as a person. I didn't understand the idea of Batman as a person. So a man who dresses up like a bat to go out and fight crime seemed very strange to me. So I related to it more as a spirit, a sort of cross between a man and an animal. So there are man dogs and man cats,
totemic
wolf man, you know, mixes in cultures all over the world, and that seemed to make sense to me. Mythic.
Yeah.
So I drew him as a sort of a spirit of a creature, really.
You made Grant change a little bit of his story, right?
What?
You influenced Grant into.
Yes, I should be wearing the earphones, really.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, Grant had written a very straight Batman story, and it had Robin in it. It's very odd. And I really didn't understand Robin. But I got to meet Grant, and I was really impressed with what his ambitions were, how much outside of comics he was looking for his inspirations. He loved Dennis Potter as a writer, great television writer. We both loved Polish animation, Jan Švankmajer's films, things like that. And we just had a great lunch exchanging influences and talking about things, at the end of which it seemed crazy to do a straight Batman comic. since we liked all these other things. So he was very happy, fortunately, to go back to the script and just and change it and make it much more of a symbolic story, not a literal story. I carried on working at DC on Neil's first series, The Sandman, which is here, and on Hellblazer, doing all the covers. And this was the series, this is the comic book series for DC Comics in America that really found a mainstream audience, an audience outside of comics.
Arkham Asylum was already that. Avec Arkham Asylum, c'était déjà le cas?
I'm not really sure that it was. I mean, Arkham sold a lot of copies, but it was still really to a Batman crowd. It was still in comic book shops and within that little world. Whereas Sandman started to be collected in these volumes.
Les femmes commençaient même à lire.
And found its way into bookstores and a bookstore audience. And then many other covers for DC, various comics and spin-offs from the Sandman series.
Mostly for the Vertigo imprint.
Mostly for Vertigo. And then the books that I was really interested in were outside of the superhero, supernatural genre. So this was a book that Neil and I did together called Mr. Punch, a memory book. It's very much about somebody misremembering the past, trying to make sense of a little violent thing that happened in their childhood in the past. And Punch and Judy is a puppet show.
Yeah, you need to explain that to French.
Okay, I did need to explain. In England, all English children know about Punch and Judy, which is a strange little puppet show that started around 250 years ago on the beach. And everybody has little memories. There's a puppet that says, "That's the way to do it," as he hits. He does a lot of hitting. Very violent.
C'est un peu l'équivalent de Guignol, mais anglais.
Yes. And there are lots of other, there's some sausages and a dog. People remember these little things, but nobody remembers the story. The story of Punch and Judy is a man is left in charge of a baby while his wife goes away. And the baby won't stop crying. And so he kills the baby. And the wife comes back and is not very happy about that, obviously. So he kills his wife. And then a policeman comes to arrest him, and he kills the policeman. It's a serial killer story, basically. And it gets worse and worse. He is finally arrested and tried to be hung by the neck. And in a great scene, he convinces the hangman to hang himself instead. And then finally, the devil comes to take Mr. Punch to hell. And the final scene is Mr. Punch kills the devil. And the last line is, and leaving Mr. Punch free to spread his words of good cheer to all the children. And this is the weirdest story ever. And if you go and see it with an audience of English children, they're all laughing at Mr. Punch hitting everybody and killing everybody. It's all great fun. There's always one or two children at the back with white faces who understand what's going on, in total shock that their parents have left them here to watch this horror show. So it's very funny. So we thought we have to do something with this. And Neil read a book that had the original script in, so we used the murders as a sort of spine for the book. And so I've done a lot of... I had done a fair amount of work with Neil and a book with Grant Morrison. I really wanted to do a book on my own. So this is my own novel called Cages, which came out of a collection of short stories, but they all seem to have the same characters in, and they all seem to be sort of set in the same world, in the same apartment block even. So it became this one book.
Est-ce que c'est l'œuvre qui vous ressemble le plus, Cages? En bande dessinée, la plus représentative.
It's my personal baby. It was how I was feeling about comics at the time. I'd done a lot of painted comics, and the storytelling seemed to be getting slower and slower. And I wanted to do a book where that had a real lightness of touch, where the storytelling is very quick and easy and flows. And also, I still thought a lot of comic book drawing was very inhuman. People would, if they got angry, they would do that, and they would stand in the same way, and it was very cartoony. It was very... it did not seem to understand the way people really talk and the way their expressions are and the way that they pause and lose track of sentences and all of those things that make dialogue so wonderful. So I wanted to have all that in Cages.
Il y a une adaptation au cinéma de prévu. Je sais pas où ça en est en fait.
Well, there's a possibility, but I can never predict what happens with films. So it's just as likely that tomorrow it will all be cancelled. So I never really like to say that it's going to happen. But I've written an adaptation of the book into a film. The strange thing that happened in Cages, since it was the first thing that I had written, as I started to get letters from people. Being an illustrator, you never get letters, because I think people assume you can't read. Yeah. But as I was writing it, I got some letters. And it was originally serialized in four parts, in 10 parts. And after the fourth issue came out, the fourth magazine came out, I started to get letters that said, oh, yeah, I see what you're doing. Yeah, fine. I get it. Very dismissive. Yeah, fine. I get it. Yeah, fine. And which was very frustrating, because I was not even halfway through, and you don't really want to hear that in a letter. So I drew this part, this section, in the next issue that made no sense at all. It was completely inexplicable. And it stopped the letters, which was the point of the exercise. All the letters stopped. And then I've continued just doing a lot of short stories and experimenting with different forms. These are comics made with colour copy machines. I like machines that try and help, that try and have a dialogue with you, like typewriters. I'm not so keen on computers for that, because they just put up an error message saying that the I can't open the file, it's damaged. Well, that's no fun. It's not playing with me. Colour copy machines, if you kick them, or if you shine lights in on them, or if you move the thing on the surface, they spit out a result as if to say, is that what you meant? And they play with you, and I like that.
Est-ce qu'on peut parler un peu est-ce qu'on peut parler de vos techniques de travail, les collages, la façon dont vous travaillez graphiquement? Est-ce que vous pouvez en dire quelques mots?
Well, I still love just to draw. I mean, this story was just done drawing. At the end of the day, what I love really more than anything is just to sit down with a blank piece of paper and a pen and just draw something. But I started using collage in art school as a way of trying to create memories. I worked on Violent Cases, which was a memory story again. And it seemed that if I had a page and there was a half-seen image and a texture of cloth and some type and a piece of a letter, all of these objects had time in them already. They had memories in them already. And it seemed to evoke a feeling quite nicely. So that's where the collage came from. And so I also have done a lot of books for children. I had some children. So it was nice to be able to do some books for them and read the books to them. And Neil had children. So it was almost inevitable that we would do some kids' books. So this is the first book that we did. Very popular book on Father's Day, swapping your dad for two goldfish. And it's just a story about a boy who really has a great idea. He really, really wants his friend's goldfish and can't think of anything to swap, and then decides, of course, I'll swap you my dad. I'm not doing anything with him. And then the second book is The Wolves in the Walls. I think both of these are out in French.
Yeah, yeah.
Both in French editions. It's a picture of a wolf playing a tuba, as they do. And the book that's just out now, literally just out, I think, in the last day or two, Crazy Hair, which started as a conversation between Neil and his daughter. Neil, if you see him around, he's very easy to spot because he has very out-of-control hair, which he suffers from a lot. And the longer it gets, the more out of control it gets. So we spent some time together writing a film, and his hair was particularly out of control at that time. And so he had a conversation with his daughter, with the daughter suggesting lots of things that might be living in his hair, as a way of getting him to get a haircut, really. And Neil turned it into a little poem that we turned into a book. So there's probably octopuses living in his hair. Or pirates. And we've done a few other books. This is Coraline, obviously turned into a film by Henry Zelick. And I think probably my favourite of Neil's books, The Graveyard Book, which has a different title in England. In France. I don't really know why it has a different title. Graveyard Book is a perfectly good title. And then these are some drawings that I'm doing right now for a book that's coming out next year. It's an edition of Smoke and Mirrors, which is a collection of short stories. But this is a really lovely, I hope lovely, illustrated edition. Some of my favourite stories are in Smoke and Mirrors, I think. Chivalry and Trollbridge, I think, are some of the best things that Neil has ever written. And then a few books with other authors. This is Ray Bradbury. A story called The Homecoming, which I understand was the story that Neil Gaiman read that really made him want to be a writer. So it was nice to come full circle and illustrate it for Ray before he died, sadly. Last year, I think he died.
Did he saw the book?
Yes, he saw the book. Yes, I saw him. He was rather ill in California, but I saw him in California and talked to him, got him to sign my copy of the book.
Okay.
And saw him about the book. And then I've done a few books now with a wonderful writer called David Almond, who writes these extraordinary, passionate, deep children's books from a very deep place, very heartfelt. The Savage is about a boy who's loses his father, and his teachers at school want him to write about his grief and try and get it out and all those sorts of consoling things that teachers try and do. But really, he just wants to write this story about this savage boy, this wild child that lives in the woods, and all his anger and fury and bitterness comes out in this child. So as soon as I read it, I just thought it was a beautiful story. And it's told a little bit in comics and a little bit in prose. And that was something I also wanted to do in the next book we did together called Slog's Dad, which again is a book about a child who loses his father, a common theme in David's writing. But this time the boy sees somebody in a park, a man in a park, and he's convinced that that's his father. And he goes to talk to him. And the whole book really is just one scene. He goes to talk to this man. And the man says, yes, I am. And the boy's friend is with him, and he doesn't believe this. He doesn't trust him at all. So he tries to catch him out and asks him a couple of questions about his wife's name and about personal things that only he would know. And he gets the answers right. And then the boy desperately wants the father to come home. But he says, no, I can't. I'm only allowed to be here for a day. And they part. And that's it. That's the whole book. And I got this book to read, and I couldn't really make any kind of sense of it. Either this is a supernatural event with a man coming back from heaven, and I'm an atheist, I'm afraid. I don't really hold with any of that stuff. I just didn't believe it. Or it's a man playing a really cruel trick on a boy, which I didn't really like that either. So I decided not to illustrate it. So instead of illustrating the text, I just let the text run as it was. And then in between, I illustrated interpretations of the text. So maybe it's a dream, maybe it's a game that he's playing with his friends. You know, maybe it's something else entirely. So when you read the book, you have these two things. The words are separate from the pictures, and you have to try and make sense of them in your own head. And so actually what happened that day, I'm still not sure. All I know for sure is that this is about a boy who really, really misses his father and wants him to come home. And then this is the book that I've just finished with David called Mouse, Bird, Snake, Wolf.
Est-ce que vous avez demandé l'explication à l'auteur?
I didn't ask for an explanation. David has been incredibly kind, letting me almost change the meaning of the book. I mean, he's been that good. And it was only after we finished that I talked to him a bit about it. But David is much happier leaving things unresolved, whereas I'm much more of a rationalist. I need to know, at least for myself, I need to know. I don't mind things being left to mull over in the audience's mind. I mean, that's the fun of fiction. But if I'm doing the book and I need to commit to pictures in the book, which are very solid, pictures are very real, whereas words can be elusive, I need to know. Mouse, Bird, Snake, Wolf is a completely different kind of book. It's a little creation story about some children who, in a world where the gods are living above them, they've created this world, they're very self-satisfied, but there are big holes left, and these children decide to try and fill the holes with new creatures. And it's about hubris, really. It's about being over-ambitious. And the mouse, the bird, the snake are okay, but the wolf causes problems. This is the children creating the wolf from sticks and stones and leaves and berries.
On voit que le style de dessin change à chaque histoire. C'est l'histoire qui commande le style que vous allez aborder, ou c'est vous qui décidez ce livre je vais le faire avec tel style parce que j'ai envie d'essayer.
Exactly. I try and everything is in the text, so the colours, the emotions, the feeling, the atmosphere, the lines that I need to use, the medium, and the way that the story is told, it all comes from the text. The text is king. Each story tends to find its own visual language that tries to hopefully puts across the atmosphere and the feelings in the best way. Coupled a little bit with what I'm interested in at the time and what the kinds of things that I'm doing at the time, but really everything is based in the text.
Vous avez écrit Cages, donc est-ce que vous n'aimeriez pas écrire vous-même un livre pour enfants?
I would like to write a children's book. In fact, I have two or three ideas noted. Unfortunately, my children are not children anymore, so the impetus is slightly gone. I used to really love when Neil would send me a new book, I'd get to read it to my daughter or my son for the first time 2 years before it would be published. And their reaction to it would colour how I would do the illustrations. How are we doing? So there are some other books that I thought I'd show you. This is a book with a wonderful musician called John Cale, who was in the Velvet Underground. I've done several things with him now. This is a book that is also just out in the bookstore over here, which is an erotic book. Always wondered why there's so much violence in comics, but very little sex, really. And yet, you know, how much violence do we come upon in our everyday lives? I hope not very much. You know, I hope very little.
Sex a lot.
But sex, you know, I think we come upon sex every day. Think about it. So I always wanted to try and do a book that tickled the imagination and the aesthetic as well as other parts of the body. I've continued to do lots of illustrations for short stories and various magazines. That's my son. He hates that picture. I should take it out of the show, really, because he really hates it. But I am allowed to do that. I am his father. I can peel my son's head. It's allowed. And then lots of record covers for different bands. This is for Counting Crows, Dream Theater. I've just put a few of these in as well. Buckethead, a guitarist who wears a Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket on his head. Michael Nyman, a lot for his of his album covers for the piano and various other films that he's done. And then a lot of American bands, Fear Factory. Oh, this is John Cale again. And that's my son again. And he loves that picture. He hated the potato peeling one, but he really loves that one because he gets to be a robot in that one. I've also done a lot of photography over the years. I got into photography on the Sandman covers. And I've published several books of photographs. Some straight photographs, some of them like this one, digitally manipulated. These are from a series of tarot images. I don't believe in tarot or anything like that, but I love the idea of trying to sum up the whole of human knowledge in 78 cards. It's a very silly, wonderful, human thing to do. This is the most recent photographs called Folk, just a series of strange clans from around the world. It was inspired by where I live. There are folk festivals, and I always thought folk music was, you know, man with a pig under one arm and a finger in the ear and playing a banjo. But it's a lot darker than that. And the folk festivals near me, these strange black-clad tribes show up with you know, metal bars and bones and all kinds of stuff. It's very weird. So I've done a series of photographs sort of based around the clannishness of folk music. So I wanted to talk to you about two projects in particular this afternoon. I know that we're here at a science fiction festival, but unfortunately both of them are based in reality and not fantasy. This is a book called The Magic of Reality that I did 2 years ago with an evolutionary biologist called Richard Dawkins. And I really admire Dawkins' writing. And at the end of his interviews, he would often get interviewed. And at the end of the interview, he would always be asked, well, what are you doing next? What's your next project? And he would keep saying, I'd really love to do a book for children. And I kept reading that and finally thought, well, I want to do that book. I want to do that book. So I got in touch with his agent, who turned out to be an amazing guy called John Brockman, who'd worked with John Cale and Lou Reed and Andy Warhol at the factory and all of this. So we had a lot in common, and he put my name forward. So I went to meet Richard, and it seemed like he'd never got very far with his idea for doing a book for children. But he did have one idea that would be a series of questions, say 12 questions about the world. And then to answer each question initially in the way that we humans have answered those questions in the past, with mythic stories, fairy stories, theological stories. And then the second part of each chapter would be our very, very best scientific explanation to explain that subject. And that seemed to be a lovely way of dealing with an introduction to science and skeptical thinking. So I went to see him, and we started work on that. So each one of the chapters is a simple question. What is the sun? What's an earthquake? What's a rainbow? Why are there so many animals in the world? A couple of slightly tricky ones. What's a miracle? Interesting.
Je réfléchis en français là, mais c'est des livres très durs à traduire parce qu'il y a du lettrage qui est intégré au graphisme.
Oh, technically very difficult. Yeah. I like making it hard for co-publishers. But with this book, actually, I offered to help. So many of the publishers sent me the spreads, and I re-illustrated them for those. But there were 30 different publishers around the world, so it was, turned out to be a lot of work. And then for the science, I'm not a scientist. So I'm a big science reader and a fan, but I'm not a scientist. So I really had to go back to school. And literally, I went back to my kids' school. I found their head of physics and head of chemistry, and I sat down with them and got them to explain certain things to me. And I had a great time. And I listened this time. As a kid, I never listened. But I enjoyed school much more as an adult. And I'd done a few things for New Scientist and a few projects that I thought would be appropriate. But probably the one that made me feel that I could do the book with Dawkins was this book. This is a book with a great, great chef called Heston Blumenthal. He's a molecular chef. He's a scientist as well. So I had spent a year with Heston trying to get inside his brain. That's what Heston's brain looks like, if you've ever wondered. Some of the illustrations were trying to create equivalents for the food. Now, a cookbook is a strange thing because all the important stuff is not there. You can't smell it. You can't taste it. All you can do is see a still picture of it. So I tried to find equivalents for something like this, which was a chocolate dish, which had a sort of wafery bit and it had little popping candies in it, which were spiky and things like that. And then things like this, the dish on the left here is hot and cold tea. This little cup comes halfway through your meal at Heston Blumenthal's restaurant. And it's hot and cold tea, but vertically in the glass. So the left half of the liquid is hot and the right half is cold. And you drink it and the left half of your mouth is hot. How does he do this? It's a miracle. And so to do the book with Richard, I did many, many sketches. Every page had to be roughed out because we had to make sure the science was right. Now, the theological side, the mythic stories, I was okay with. So they went through pretty easily. But the science pages were tough. So I would do things like that, and Richard would shake his head and say, no, 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 we can't have red raindrops. That's completely unscientific. So everything had to go through many approval processes. But we finally end up with something that explains how a rainbow works, how the beam of light is split and then reflected off the back of the drop, and then because of the curvature, the colours twist in space and come back in the order that you see them in your eye. Amazing. All of this was great fun to me. And as I said, I went back to school. I did the Experimentum Crucis with my kids and teachers, and great fun. And the great thing about working with Richard Dawkins is that he knows everybody. So when we had to do a piece about Cassini heading away from Earth and doing its little dogleg path round Jupiter out towards Saturn, Richard actually didn't know what the path was. He thought he had a rough idea, and I certainly didn't know. But he said, well, I know Carolyn Porco. She set up the Cassini mission. Here's her email. She'd love to talk to you about it. So it was fantastic. I had to do a piece about the human immune system when a not a very pleasant character on a plane sneezes and the germs travel down the air-conditioned system and come out in front of my son, who posed for that drawing. The germs go into your body and your immune system reacts. And I didn't know how that worked, and Richard really didn't know how that worked. But his next-door neighbor, turned out to be a world-class immunologist. So he came over for coffee, and he talked us through. It was fantastic. So we got that in the end. How are we doing? The other project I wanted to talk to you about, very quickly, because time is running out, is I've been involved in film a little bit. So I've done some production design work. These are for the Harry Potter films.
The third one?
Pardon me?
No, le troisième Harry Potter.
You said that in English.
Yeah.
I worked on the second and third one. I did a little bit of work on the second one, but the third one was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, and he was fantastic. And so I was kind of inspired to do more work, and I did the Dementors and some of the other things. And then I directed some short films because I fancied just making a film. And nobody was going to knock on my door and give me money to make a film. So I thought I'd just need to make some. So I made a small, funny one, which was the week before, and then this film, Neon, which is a sort of a rather somber, melancholy ghost story set in Venice. And then Miramask, which showed this morning, here, fantasy film with Neil.
Qui avait été projeté ici il y a quelques années, que moi j'ai vu ici il y a quelques années. J'ai une question à propos de Miramask, peut-être. Apparemment, c'est la première fois que le travail avec Neil s'est un peu mal passé. Vous vous entendiez moins bien.
Actually, what happened was Neil and I have always worked together separately, apart. Neil writes, I draw, and we never cross that boundary. Whenever there's a question about the words, Neil has final cut. Whenever there's a question about the pictures, I have final cut. And we've worked very well for 20 years like that. And then we had to do Miramask, and Neil was going to write it, but I wanted to be in the room when he was writing it. Not to interfere, really, but just because I had to direct the film and design it and then sit in a studio for a year helping to create the animation. And I had to work with the actors. I knew what the budget was. The budget for the film was about 50 euro. You know, I mean, it wasn't quite that low, but it was ridiculously low. So I knew what we could do and what we could not do. And I also knew that Neil wasn't so clear about that. So I just needed to be in the room to be able to say, we just can't afford to do that. But I ended up writing little bits. And as we were creating it together, it turns out we work in completely different ways. I like to plan everything out, and I like to have everything on little pieces of paper written in front of me. And Neil just fires up his computer in the morning and starts madly typing stuff. And every time he did that, it would drive me crazy because I couldn't see where he was going. And every time I got my little pieces of paper out, it would drive Neil crazy. So we ended up at opposite ends of this house. It was a four-story house, and I was right at the very top where the heat and the grand piano was, and Neil was right at the very, very bottom where the cold and Radio 4, BBC Radio was, and the kitchen, and we separated ourselves. So I wanted to talk to you about this project. This is called The Gospel of Us. It is a film that was shot during a three-day live theatrical play. It was created by Michael Sheen, who's a wonderful actor. He was in... He played Tony Blair in The Queen, and he played Brian Clough in a great film called The Damned United, but he's also in the Twilight films and the Tron film and things like this. Great, great actor. And he comes from a town called Port Talbot in Wales. And Port Talbot always used to have passion plays. And he wanted to go back to Port Talbot and create a passion play, a three-day live play where he would play a Christ-like figure for 72 hours straight without breaking character. And so I met up with Michael actually when he was doing some research in Oberammergau in Germany, because they put on a huge passion play there. And I couldn't understand why nobody was going to shoot this as a film. The BBC were going to be there to do a documentary about how it was put together, but nobody was going to shoot it as a film. So Michael just said, well, you do it. So I said, oh, well, okay, I'll do it. And I went back to England and thought, Christ, what did I say? What have I committed to? And so 3 days of chaos with 10 cameras, because, again, we had a tiny budget. We turned up in Port Talbot. I was there with 9 other cameramen. I shot as well, with a rough idea of what would happen, because I'd seen the rehearsals. But then, so I could brief the cameramen of where you've got to stand and what you've got to shoot. But then 20,000 people showed up. A wave of people showed up, and so all my plans went out the window. And we just had to. My new plan was just shoot anything that moves. Just shoot it. And I'll make sense of it later. So I took all the footage back, acres and acres of footage, back home. And Port Talbot is a strange place. It's quite a beautiful place, but it has an industrial part that looks like Blade Runner. And then the town itself is quite run down. So the whole project started a month before with graffiti artists going out spraying images of Michael Sheen as this character called the teacher on walls and fences. And notices went up all over the town saying, have you seen this man? This man is missing. Do you see me? So it built a huge amount of interest up in the town. And then the whole film started, and the whole play started at 6 o'clock in the morning at dawn on Easter 2011 with this little old man who stood up as soon as the first chink of sunlight appeared and sang this beautiful little song in Welsh. And it was really lovely. And only about 10 people saw that. That was the whole audience, about 10 people. And then we went down to the beach, and about 300 people saw this line of people in the water. And Michael appeared as the teacher, and there he is. And he was baptized in the sea, and that was the beginning of the whole thing. Now, for the film, of course, I had absolutely no control over anything that happened. I had no control over anything that anybody said, the behavior of the audience. And so this shot here looks very beautiful and clean. I think I'm very happy with this shot. The single black figure coming out of the dunes, the three little girls in white on the dune above. But in actual fact, there were photographers running across the picture. There was litter on the beach blowing around. There was an old Tesco's bag blowing around the beach. I had to digitally paint out all this stuff to try and make a clean image. And that had to happen all the way through the film. There he is getting baptized by a character called the Stranger, who is this sort of storyteller figure. That night I met up with Michael on the mountain as he'd managed to get away from the crowds and shot little bits in between. So there are a few little scenes away from the crowds. This is towards the end. So he's tried. Even though it's a contemporary story, it's a modern-day story with a sort of paramilitary presence in Wales. They try him, and he picks up the cross and drags it through. He dragged this cross for 4 miles through Port Talbot, and it was a very hot day. And then finally, he's crucified on a roundabout in front of the ocean, in front of thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people. So that's that one. And then I've just got a few things at the end, the projects that I'm kind of working on at the moment. This is a film that I shot a couple of years ago called Luna. It's about two couples who meet over a long weekend, and one of the couples has lost a baby. So their emotions are very raw. And the man in the family has got a bit of a drinking problem, so things get very tense and overwrought. And all the old skeletons from their past come out of the cupboard. But at the same time, the life of this baby is lived out in a series of sort of strange fantasy sequences, dream sequences, at different ages. So it's as if this is the weekend when the grieving finally begins to stop, and they can lay the child to rest and move on. Four wonderful actors, including Stephanie Leonidas, who came back from Mirror Mask to be in it. There she is. The two men in the story are artists, and they draw images in a little game called Exquisite Corpse, where you make a drawing and then you swap it with your partner and you swap it back and continue the drawing.
Cadavre exquis.
Indeed, indeed. And all of the dreams, the fantasies, come out of these drawings. And I did the drawings for one of the guys, and my friend in America, Baron Story, a wonderful illustrator, did the drawings for the other man. And that's my son again. He gets to be in everything I do. My family are in everything I do. But he is an actor. He's done some West End plays. But he got to be twins in this strange little film. So we're finishing the animation at the moment. We had to put it on hold. This is the peril of low-budget filmmaking. probably anywhere, but especially in England. I think film is much more appreciated and supported in France than in England. We struggle all the time to get films made. And so our money ran away, and we had to refinance the film, and it's taken a long time to finish. But I hope we will be there. Early next year, I think we'll finish.
Le film précédent, il est terminé, il est sorti.
The Gospel of Us?
Yeah.
The Gospel of Us is done. The premiere was in Port Talbot. The first time ever this tiny little Welsh town had ever had a world premiere of a film ever. The one and only time I will ever sell out 6 multiplex screens for 3 runs, you know, for a full week. That was great. No, it's out. We're working with a sales agent now to get it released in the rest of the world, including France. And it is out on DVD. If anybody wants to order an English copy, it's out on DVD. Nearly there. This is some of the computer animation that we're working on at the moment. So it won't look like that in the end. This is just the model. There is a little crab in the film that has kept me company for 4 years now as I've been trying to finish this film. These are just some a couple more publishing projects. I've been traveling a lot, and I always sketch all the time. So I've been making these little travel sketchbooks, and they have taught me so much about drawing. I've discovered so much, not just about the places, but about mark making and finding new shapes, new ways of interpreting things. These sketchbooks have meant the world to me, really. This is Bilbao. And then this painting, the print is in the show here. I've been working on paintings and drawings based on silent cinema, which is the era of film that I really love. I like films from all eras, but there's something about silent films. The fact that you can see the language of film being created in front of your eyes, I just really love. So I've been painting these images based on either a specific still or the feeling in the film as a whole, as a way of trying to make sense of why I love these images so much, these misty, insubstantial, difficult, grainy, scratchy images. They embedded themselves in my head when I was a very little boy, and I've been trying to work them out ever since. This is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, one of my favorite films, and is an inspiration for a new book I'm doing as well. This book, which is called Caligaro, a new graphic novel, which I'm working on at the moment, slowly. It's a long book. It'll take time. But maybe in a couple of years I'll have it finished. And then a new book of short stories. I continue to do these all the time. This was a story written by an anonymous Chinese reporter about a huge scandal in China. Whole villages that have come down with AIDS because they've been convinced that they should sell their own blood. Very tragic story, but the story is in the show here if you want to read it. And then I've been doing these exhibition stories. How are we doing? Nearly there. This is The Coast Road, which is a story that takes place in England around the coast of England. And then the story is told in paintings and drawings and photographs and took up the whole of the gallery. So you walk in the gallery and read the story around the room. And I love doing gallery shows, but you have a strange relationship in a gallery. You walk into a big white space and pick on something and walk up to it and, you know, look around a bit. And everything's very bitty and disconnected often. And I wanted to do a story show. So people still walk into the room, they still find something, but very quickly realize it's linked. And they go back to the beginning, and they read it through. And instead of spending 10 minutes at the gallery, they'll spend an hour there reading it through. And it was quite an emotional story, so we had some tears at the end, which was great. And then this was another story called The Rut, which took place in a gallery in London. And it involved, there was a dead body behind a screen and all sorts of things. And the story was a single event, but split into three interpretations. So the lead into the story took you into the room, and then you were free to explore the room and try and put the pieces of the story together in your own head as to what exactly happened. And then the most recent one is called Blue Tree, which I did at a gallery near me, which is a story involving this huge tree that becomes so complicated. Its root system becomes so complex, it starts to develop consciousness. And it grows out into the world and starts to understand and observe we humans living, and it draws its own conclusions about why people do what they do. And this was a story really for me, having spent a year with Richard Dawkins, the scientist, and a view of the world in a very scientific way, and a year on The Gospel of Us, looking at the world through myth and theology and a sort of fictionalized version of the way the world works, trying to bring those two together in this story. And it was told in illustrations and comics. And then in the middle of the gallery was a huge real blue tree that grew out through the gallery and out to the street. And then on the day of the opening of the show, which was on a Saturday, on the Saturday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, I went around the town and planted blue branches everywhere around the town with the little Christmas bauble on, with a clear bauble with a little message inside. So everybody in the town woke up, and there were these blue branches growing all the way around the town, leading up to the show. That's it, in the middle of the show. And I think, there we go. And I think that's it. That's all. Thank you for
merci,
listening.
Merci à tous. Merci à David McKean. It
was really great.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
Are we all right? Any last question? Or,
I think we don't have time.
Okay, thank you.
Merci beaucoup.
Just a second, thank you, God.